And the title of his talk is Tests of the Equivalence Principle and the Gravitational Inverse Square Law. So as before, there will be two talks in the morning session, but feel free to ask questions during the talk.
Good morning. I've been asked to talk about tests of the equivalence principle and the inverse square law. The equivalence principle has two flavors, called the weak and the strong equivalence principle. And the weak equivalence principle applies the equivalence principle to all non-gravitational forms of energy, and the strong equivalence principle includes gravitational energy. Mostly be telling you about relatively recent results and a little bit about how they were obtained. A lot of the work that I'll be talking about was done by our group at the University of Washington, and the people involved are listed here. You should, of course, realize that if the equivalence principle were violated, down no longer has unique meaning. Different materials would fall, in general, in different directions. And it's easy to see that in this little cartoon here that shows a cross-section through the Earth. Here's a laboratory at our temperate latitudes. And if we ask what direction is down, well, down is defined by the sum of the gravitational force vector pointing towards the center of the Earth and the inertial force pointing outward from the polar axis. And so down, this little angle epsilon depends on the ratio of the gravitational to inertial masses. This little angle at 45 degrees, which is where the effect is maximum, is about a tenth of a degree. And the tests I'll be talking about basically compare the direction of down for different materials. Okay, so you're taking this little angle of a tenth of a degree, and you're comparing that angle for different materials to a precision that approaches a part in 10 to the 13. Okay? And it's conventional to interpret the results as constraints on an additional Yukawa interaction, in addition to the normal gravitational interaction. And the Yukawa is assumed to have a form which is proportional to some generalized charge, which could be anything as far as we know, charge to mass ratio of the first body times the charge to mass ratio of the second body. And it's clear that if there, the equivalence principle violating interaction was a scalar, alpha had to be greater than zero, and if it's a vector interaction, alpha must be less than zero. Now, what length scales are interesting as far as testing the equivalence principle? All length scales are interesting, okay? But to follow George Orwell, although all scales are equal, some are more equal than others, okay? And for instance, an infinite length scale corresponds to a massless particle, a kind of a seesaw mass. The mass of the z squared divided by a Planck mass corresponds to a length scale of 30 centimeters. A TeV squared over a Planck mass corresponds to a fraction of a millimeter. And of course, the Planck length is completely inaccessible to any of the experiments that I could be talking about. And as of a few years ago, the constraints on the equivalence principle violating interaction, where what we plot on the logarithmic scale vertically, the absolute value of alpha, the strength, and on the horizontal scale, logarithmically, the range, okay? And you see this general form that at long distances, the constraints are quite good. At short distances, the constraints are relatively weaker, okay? And they come from a bunch of different experiments. I don't want to go through them, what they all are, okay? But what you do see, that there's one curve here that's dashed, and that dashed curve comes is not strictly an equivalence principle test. It's a test for an additional Yukawa interaction, and it comes from laser ranging to the moon, looking for a departure of the 1 over r squared force law. Okay. And you see that at long distances, for instance, this is roughly the scale of the solar system over here. We know that the equivalence principle works extremely well. Okay. At short distances, we know it works to a lesser degree. And the reason why the constraints are poorer at short distances is simply at short distances, the gravitational effects are smaller. And as a consequence, it's harder to test them with the same fractional accuracy. See, I guess I have to do this. The way these experiments are done is you create what we call a composition dipole, two masses of one material, let's say two masses of a different material, forming a dipole of composition. And it sits on a turntable. The turntable revolves at a very uniform rate. And on this rotating turntable, there's an optical system that looks at a mirror on this dipole. And the idea is if these objects fell with a different acceleration than those objects, when the turntable is oriented, as I show you right here, this little composition dipole would tend to twist in the counterclockwise direction. That would deflect the light beam in one sense. But then when the whole apparatus is rotated 180 degrees, the deflection will have the opposite sense. And so what you would see if you looked at the deflection of the light beam as a function of the rotation of the angle of the turntable, you would see a sine wave signal if the principle of equivalence did not hold. If the principle of equivalence held, you would just see a constant signal. Okay. So that's the principle. The whole thing is in the execution. Okay, the turntable has to be very, very smooth, very, very accurate. Especially important, the composition dipole has to be situated in a very flat gravitational field, because we're assuming, in fact, that the gravitational field is absolutely flat, and that the only way you could see a sine wave signal is if the different objects accelerated differently in that field. But of course, any real field has a gradient, and as you turn the apparatus around, the test bodies are moving in a gradient. And excuse me, I got a bad cold this weekend. You will see an apparent violation of the equivalence principle. It's not really a violation of the equivalence principle. The trouble is your laboratory isn't small enough so that you can't replace the gravitational field by an acceleration. And because this is sets a fundamental limit to how well you can test the equivalence principle, I go through this a little bit. The energy of an object in an external field can be expressed in terms of a spherical multipole formalism. And the factor over here, e to the minus I omega t, is separated out because that depends on the rotation of the turntable. And you can see that the energy, the derivative of this energy with respect to the angle, is the torque that will be on that composition dipole. The terms that are particularly important are the ones that vary with the angle. In other words, where m is 1. And you see that the false effects are a product of two terms, a inner multipole that describes the mass distribution in your dipole, and the outer multipole that describes the mass distribution of the external world. Okay? And to get the kind of precision we need, we have to make this as small as possible and that as small as possible. Making that as small as possible excuse me, means making the local gravitational field as flat as possible. And the leading terms are something that would look like this, a mass distribution on the pendulum that looked like that. Well, that's impossible, because if this fiber is perfectly flexible, it has to sit directly below the center of mass. So this is automatically zero. These terms are not automatically zero. Asymmetries of these kinds are not automatically zero. And so what we have to do is design the apparatus, the pendulum, so that these kind of terms vanish to the degree we are able. That means make this small. And we have to make the local field gradient as flat as possible. That means making that small. To do that, you need to have a way to measure the gradients. And the way we do it is with this rather bizarre pendulum hanging from a very fine fiber. And it has basically four trays with many little holes that can hold tiny titanium spheres. And we can put the spheres in various places on this thing to form either a way to measure a particular multiple component of the gradient. For instance, with the spheres like that, we measure the what we call the 2-1 component of the gradient. With the spheres shown here, we measure the 3-1 component of the gradient, and so on. So this is a device for decomposing the gradients into their multiple components, which then allows you to flatten the field multiple component by multiple component. And this shows you what it looks like in a current experimental configuration that we're using. These two pieces cancel the 2-1 component of the gradient. These pieces here cancel the 3-1 component of the gradient, and so on. The pendulum itself looks like, as shown right here, this actually has 8 test bodies, one pair, another pair. And so the two pairs are made of, in this case, titanium. Two other pairs are made out of beryllium. Okay? And the reason for having such a complicated-looking thing is that these individual test bodies, barrel shapes, have the property that their quadrupole moments vanish and their L equals 4 moments vanish. All their odd moments vanish. Okay. And there are 8 of them, so that this complete arrangement has a vanishing quadrupole moment and a vanishing L equals 4 moment. The pendulum is suspended from a fine fiber that sticks up here. It's about a meter long. And there are mirrors on this. You can see one of the mirrors. An optical beam reflects off those mirrors and measures the deflection. This thing on the bottom that you see here is what we call our Ronald Reagan Memorial Social Safety Net. Okay, that's in case there's a little earthquake and this fiber breaks. It catches the torsion pendulum before it's had a chance to fall very far. Okay, this whole thing is made with very high mechanical accuracy. Everything is coated with gold, and it sits inside a gold-coated electrostatic shield, lots of magnetic shielding, temperature control, etc. This just shows you the gravity gradient compensating mechanism. For theorists, all you should know is that you know, there's a lot of work that goes into making the field very flat. As far as we know, it's the flattest field on the face of the Earth. Okay. And the way that data is taken is you run for a while with the dipole oriented this way in the rotating frame, and then you rotate the top of the fiber by 180 degrees, so the dipole is oriented like that, and then you run. And you can see what this does is, if the turntable were not turning absolutely uniformly, it will have exactly the same effect on the twist in this orientation as it would in that orientation. But a true signal that had to do with how the dipole is oriented in space would change sign here. And so the data is taken in pairs, and with the two different orientations, switching every day from one to the next. Okay. And you see, if you look at this, there is a slight drift in the signal. What that's due to is that the local gradient is changing a little bit. In other words, we cancel the gradient at one point in the time, but a little while later, you know, maybe some rain has fallen or something like that, and the gradient changes a little bit. And so there's one effect. And the other effect is that if the turntable properties, rotation properties, drift very slightly, you'll see a change here. But we can subtract all those effects, and we're left with something that's very precise. Okay, this just shows you a little history. In the year 2004, 2005, the points where we were measuring equivalence principle data are shown in these big bands here. And then the points when we're measuring what is the gradient are shown in these different color bands right there. And the times in between aren't that we're not doing anything. It's that we're continually trying to improve the apparatus. This shows you the effect of the changing gravity gradient. So what we do here is we're measuring the gradient inside the compensators where we flatten the field. Okay? And what you can do is you can take the gradient compensators and rotate them slightly so that they no longer cancel the gradient exactly. Okay? And that's shown right here. As you move around here, what you're doing is you're rotating the gradient compensators. And at that point, that's the intersection of 0 and 0. Okay, this is the signal, the acceleration in the north-south direction. That's the acceleration in the east-west direction. And you can, whoops. Is this better? Okay. And inside this square is the region that we can measure. If we rotate the gradient compensators too much, the signal is simply too big to fit on our scale. Okay? And this shows what blown up version in that box. And you can see that at the situation when the gradient compensators are in their correct orientation, the gradient is almost exactly canceled. What's shown over here are the residuals. This is measured at one point in time, and this is measured in another. And the difference between these two points here, or the two points over there, is just the gradient changing due to you know, different amounts of water content in the Earth near the laboratory. And the point to notice is that the angular twist that we measure are some fraction of a nanoradian. A nanoradian is an awfully small deflection. In the US, I explained that if someone in San Francisco held up a millimeter and you were in Seattle and you could see it, the angle of that millimeter, as apparent to you, would be a nanoradian about. This shows the new constraints that come from the experiment that I just told you, their preliminary results. This corresponds to looking at things falling in the field of the Earth. Okay, this is the Earth as a whole. This corresponds to the local topography near our laboratory. In the region in between, with the length scale from 10 kilometers to about 10 to the third kilometers, it's very difficult to model the effect of the Earth with much precision, so we don't fold a constraint here. Here it's basically falling in the field of the entire Earth, and here it's falling in the field of the local topography. And this corresponds to falling in the field of the Sun. You should realize in these equivalence principle tests, you could watch the test bodies falling towards any object that you choose, as long as the object has a component in the horizontal plane. Okay? And so here we've chosen to demodulate the signal towards the Sun. In a minute, I will show you what happens when we demodulate the signal towards the center of the galaxy and why we would care to do that. Yes? Yes.
A scalar field whose mass is 10 to the minus 3 EV or 10 to the minus 2 EV with rather generic gravitational couplings?
Yeah, that will come quite naturally later in the talk when I talk about the inverse square law at short distances.
Okay.
But you're correct to point out that at these short distances, the direct test, the equivalence principle, are not very sensitive. Now, the trouble is my transparencies come in both portrait and landscape. Okay. Now, I mentioned that we watch things fall towards the center of our galaxy. And what I try to show you here is, well, why is that interesting? So the acceleration towards the center of the galaxy, of the solar system towards the center of the galaxy, is 2 times 10 to the minus 8 meters per second squared, roughly. Okay. That acceleration we can decompose into a part which is, I'm sorry. This is the acceleration of luminous matter to the galactic dark matter, okay? So the acceleration of our solar system towards the center is roughly 3/4 due to luminous matter, and roughly 1/4 due to the dark matter at the center of our galaxy. Although dark matter dominates the mass of the entire galaxy, most of the dark matter is outside the radius of the solar system. Okay. But roughly 1/4 of our acceleration towards the center of the galaxy is due to the dark matter inside our radius. Okay. And of that, we can this is the acceleration. Let's suppose that the acceleration of dark matter, due to dark matter, is a gravitational piece and an additional non-gravitational piece. Why would you think that? Well, all of our evidence for dark matter really comes from its gravitational effects on either matter or photons. Okay? But we really don't know what the dark matter is. And so it's a profound assumption, a very sensible one, but a profound one nevertheless, to say that the only interaction between dark matter and luminous matter is only long-range interaction, is gravitational. And so what we'd like to do is test that if we can. And so the way we can test that is to see if to what degree the acceleration of luminous matter towards dark matter obeys the principle of equivalence. And the reason we can do that is because we have such incredible resolution on differential acceleration. Okay, this resolution on differential acceleration, 2 to the 10 to the minus 13 centimeters per second squared, to get some appreciation how small that is, suppose at the time of Pericles in ancient Athens, okay, you had a pair of test bodies, and you set one of them at rest, and you gave the other this acceleration. And you kept that acceleration constant until today. Okay? Then that test body that had this acceleration today would be moving almost exactly as fast as the end of the hour hand on a typical wall clock. Okay? So this is a very stringent constraint on the acceleration difference. Okay? What we assume is that the gravitational component of acceleration obeys the principle of equivalence exactly, but that any non-gravitational component acceleration will violate the principle of equivalence. Okay? And what we want to deduce, we measure this, but what we want to deduce is that. Okay? How do you do that? We do that by making the following argument. Any non-gravitational component would presumably have to arise from a scalar interaction, because a vector interaction where like charges repel would blow apart the dark matter halo, okay? Would tend to destabilize it, whereas a scalar interaction would stabilize the halo, okay? And to make some stab at what are the effects of such a scalar interaction, we make a tree-level approximation for the scalar charge of electrically neutral bodies. Namely, we say there's some arbitrary scalar charge on the electron, an arbitrary scalar charge on the proton. We're only sensitive to some of those because we have electrically neutral bodies. There's some arbitrary scalar charge on the neutron. And then we define this parameter psi, which is some function of these scalar charges. And we can be sensitive to that function. And then ask, what is the upper limit on the non-gravitational acceleration of neutral hydrogen by galactic dark matter as a function of this angle which characterizes the ratio of scalar charges? And what you see is that minus 45 degrees, the upper limit on the acceleration, non-gravitational acceleration of dark matter by luminous matter, is zero. There can't be any. Well, that's just a simple tautology, because when at this parameter psi is minus 45 degrees, it corresponds to hydrogen having no net scalar charge. So of course it's zero there. The interesting situation occurs somewhere around here, where the scalar charges are nearly proportional to the masses of the objects. Okay, and you see we're combining all these different experiments together that I listed right here, done by our group. We can set an upper limit at the 95% confidence interval on a non-gravitational component of the acceleration of luminous matter by dark matter, galactic dark matter, at about 5%. So it's an interesting result. Okay, you didn't know for sure that that was true. Of course, that's what most sane people would have assumed, but you like to have a laboratory test, and there it is. In a minute, I will be talking about laser ranging to the moon.
How sensitive is this to the amount of dark matter inside the solar radius? Because I've heard astronomers claim that there is virtually no dark matter between the center of the galaxy and our solar system, that it's all
right
outside of that.
And for the excuse me, for that reason, we don't have a very sensitive test. In other words, if the acceleration of dark matter compared to the total acceleration is very small, then we have a very poor test, right? Because you're measuring a difference in acceleration, and you got to compare that to how different could the effect be at maximum, so to speak. Okay, and if the acceleration of the Earth towards the Sun is entirely dominated by luminous matter, which it is, the luminous matter in the Sun, okay, then we can't make an interesting statement. Is it clear or?
Maybe, I mean, if there is no dark matter inside the solar radius, then of course you can't get any constraints on the non-gravitational interactions of luminous matter and dark matter by looking at acceleration towards the center.
That's right. We can't learn anything about the properties of the gravitational properties of dark matter by looking at a system where the role of dark matter is negligible. We have to look in a place where dark matter has an appreciable contribution. Because we set a limit on the differential acceleration. That has to, the physical statement compares that difference to the total acceleration that is ascribed to the dark matter. I can talk to you more later if it's not clear. In laser ranging to the moon, this is a marvelously precise thing, and it's a test of the equivalence principle, because basically what you can do is you can interpret it as comparison of the rate at which the Earth falls towards the sun and the moon fall towards the sun. Okay, and that tests a number of things. It tests, very importantly, the strong equivalence principle, i.e., the Earth has roughly 5 parts in 10^9 of its mass, a negative 5 parts in 10^9 of its mass, has disappeared in gravitational self-binding. The moon is a much smaller fraction. And so when you compare the Earth and the moon falling towards the sun, you are able to test that small component of its mass that is gravitational self-energy. In other words, you're able to test the equivalence principle for gravitational self-energy, which is, you know, a nonlinear property of gravity. Einstein's prediction, of course, is that it falls just like anything else. You'd like to test that. And laser ranging to the moon tests that. But laser ranging to the moon is a little more Catholic than that. It tests any difference between the Earth and the moon falling towards the sun. And the Earth and moon test bodies differ by their amount of gravitational self-energy, but they also differ by the fact that they have different compositions. The Earth has a mantle which is made out of more or less the same material as the moon, but the Earth has an appreciable iron nickel core and the moon doesn't. And so laser ranging is checking the combination of two things: the gravitational self-energy, which is appreciable for the Earth and not for the moon, and this composition difference. And so what we can do to separate these two effects is we could make a mini Earth's core test body and a mini moon or mantle test body, watch them fall towards the sun. And these have negligible gravitational binding energy. In fact, any conceivable laboratory object has a negligible gravitational self-energy compared to the precision with which one can study these things, okay? But the number of centimeters per second squared different acceleration of due to composition will be exactly the same for these little test bodies as it would be for an enormous body. And so we can separate the strong and weak equivalence principle from laser in the laser ranging test, which I will talk about in a minute. Okay? And so the eta parameter, the equivalence principle violating parameter associated with the strong equivalence principle, has to do with the difference in the component fraction of gravitational self-energy. Okay, and in 1999, we did an experiment which combined with laser lunar ranging to the laser lunar ranging to test the equivalence principle for gravitational self-energy at roughly a part per thousand. And then we have a more recent result which tests this roughly at 3 times better. And they're currently about equal contributions from the laser ranging test and our little test here. But the point is, this is a test of the strong equivalence principle. How does gravitational self-energy fall in the gravitational field? Now I'd like to turn to laser ranging. You may not appreciate all the things that laser ranging to the moon provides. It's the best available test of the strong equivalence principle. Okay. It's a very sensitive test for composition-dependent equivalence principle. It's the best test we have of the time variation of Newton's constant. Okay. It's the best test we have of gravitomagnetism. Okay. It's currently the best probe of the relativistic geodetic precession, although a gravity probe B will is expected to beat that. Okay. And it's the most sensitive test of the inverse square law. All this comes from laser ranging to the moon. And the reason is that the Earth-Moon system is like a giant oscillator, okay, a gravitationally bound oscillator, where all non-gravitational effects are essentially negligible. Okay? And you can ask all kinds of interesting questions. It's also about the best test for a large-scale scalar field. Okay? If there were a large-scale scalar field and the Earth, the Earth-Moon oscillator is going around like this, it's going to see an anisotropy, okay, that has nothing to do with where the sun is or where the other planets are, but what's the direction of this large-scale scalar field. And that's a very, the data is really amazingly precise. It works by taking advantage of things that were put up over 30 years ago by the Apollo astronauts. These are arrays of retroreflectors. You see they're pretty small. It's about a meter square kind of thing. And what we do is fire a laser through a telescope, and some of the photons hit this little square meter. Most of the photons are hit a big patch on the moon with a scale roughly kilometer. Okay. And then those photons are reflected back by these little retroreflectors. Their diffraction limit is characteristic of a few centimeters scale. And so some of those photons that hit here eventually make it back to your telescope on the Earth. Now, just show you how these tests work. Let's take one particularly easy one to understand. Okay. Suppose that the Earth and the Moon fell towards the Sun with different accelerations because gravitational self-energy didn't obey the principle of equivalence, for example. Then the Moon's orbit about the Earth would be displaced a little bit from the Earth itself, okay, because the differential acceleration of these two bodies towards the Sun. Okay. And what you expect is a signal that looks sort of like I show you right here. The departure from a centered orbit shows up most in the direction towards the Sun or exactly away from the Sun. And there would be nothing to see at first quarter or third quarter. Okay. Now, the reason I point this out is that for technical reasons, the data that has existed up to this point is concentrated at first quarter and third quarter. Okay? The reason is that the you obviously can't take data at new moon. That's when the moon and the sun are nearly in the same direction, because no telescope is going to allow you to let sunlight fall on the telescope. Okay, that's a given. Okay. But the data was also could not be taken at full moon, because the background photons from the full moon swamp the signal from the laser photons that were reflecting off the moon. Okay, and so most of the data is taken when the signal is expected to be very, very small. Okay. And in fact, the reason that this whole laser ranging to the moon can work with such precision is that the signals that you expect all happen at definite frequencies. Okay, there are many, many frequencies involved, okay, but they all happen at frequencies you know very, very well. Okay, but if you're only taking data at not, if you're taking your data that's not sampled uniformly, across the angle, your ability to separate one frequency from the other is impaired. Okay, the different frequencies are orthogonal if you integrate over all angles, but if you don't, then you know things can get confused. Okay, so that's that's been a problem historically, limiting the precision of the laser ranging. Nevertheless, it's still amazingly good, as I try to show you here. Here are the constraints on alpha as a function of the range, and you can see the laser ranging to the moon is, it gives you by far the most stringent constraint. You know, Kepler's laws on the planets and so on are nowhere as good as laser ranging to the moon, simply because you don't know where the planets are at all in comparison to the precision of the moon. At this point, today we know the shape of the moon's orbit about the Earth with a precision of about 4 millimeters. Okay, think about 4 millimeters. Okay. So there's a new project that was begun at the University of Washington and is now headed by Tom Murphy at UCSD. We call Apollo. It's a next generation test of a next generation lunar laser ranging test. And the people involved are listed here. It's joint UCSD, University of Washington, Harvard University. But it was originally started at the University of Washington. And it exploits this powerful telescope. You all know about the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Well, this is, 100 meters away from the Sloan telescope. It's a 3.5 meter telescope at a good sight, a modern instrument. And this picture shows you results which have been a long time in coming. This is just about a week old. This is data taken during the full moon when no one else before was able to operate. Okay, and this peak, this is a spectrum, this time runs this way in nanoseconds, and the vertical axis are counts. And these are a series of runs that were taken over a 30-minute period. And you see this big spike here. These are the photons shining to the moon, hitting the retroreflector, coming back to the Earth, OK? And what's interesting, in these 30 seconds, we got as many photons back as the US laser ranging facility did over 3 years, OK? So the point is, we have a much higher data rate, OK? And therefore, we can study all kinds of things that were impossible before. We can sample more uniformly across the all angles. Okay, we can study systematic effects. For instance, one thing that's always bothered people was as the sunlight hits the retroreflectors, exactly how much do they expand? Okay, you had to model that before, but now we continuously look at four different retroreflectors, one after the other, like that. Okay, and so we can watch as the terminator crosses a retroreflector and see how it expands and things like that. So you can appreciate if you have a much higher data rate, there are all kinds of things that you can study. And we expect that the individual ranges will have a precision of 1 millimeter, and that then when you combine them with this kind of data rate, we can investigate the systematics well enough so that we can get the distance from the center of the moon to the center of the Earth to about a tenth of a millimeter. It hasn't been done yet, but that's our expectation. Therefore, all of these tests will improve over time by roughly that factor. And this shows you what is expected. This has not been achieved yet, okay? But expect the test of the strong equivalence principle, 3 times 10 to the minus 5, the weak equivalence principle, gravitomagnetism, 10 to the minus 4, G dot over G, 10 to the minus 13 per year, okay? Geodetic precession, and so on. Okay. And the time scale for achieving these are shown there. The results get better at different rates depending on, is the signal one that grows secularly with time or is it constant and so on. Okay. That's why these rates are different. Now I'm turning to the second part of the talk, which is tests of the inverse square law. it's important to realize one feature about tests of the inverse square law. Any one test you devise is only sensitive to a range of length scales. And it's illustrated quite clearly if you consider a Keplerian test where you have two satellites orbiting a central body, and you see this Kepler's law work, okay, for the ratio of the periods to the ratio of the semi-major axes. And it's clear that if there was something that violated the inverse square law, which is the basis of this prediction, that had a length scale shorter than the radius to the inner planet, it would have died out by the time it got the inner planet, of course died out by the time it got to the outer planet, and therefore you're completely insensitive to it. But what you might not have thought ahead of time is suppose it had a range bigger than the radius to the outer planet, okay, then it would be operating in full on the inner planet, but also operating in full on the outer planet, and so this would just simply look like a renormalization of Newton's constant. Again, nothing to test. And so this test would be sensitive to length scales between the radii of the two planets. Okay, but that's true in general. And that explains why these constraints that are shown here have the form they do. They're characteristic of the length scales in the experiment. Okay? And so to make a broad gauge, you can't do a single experiment that is a broad gauge test like you could for the principle of equivalence. Okay? And you see, the astronomical and satellite tests are quite good, but they poop out at about 10 to the 7th kilometer, meters or so. Okay? In this regime, you're sensitive to and the only results we have are kind of geophysical tests, and they're the most difficult of all to do very precisely. And then down here we come to laboratory tests, okay? But they have lost their precision as of a few years ago when the length scale gets below a centimeter. And the reason for that is simply that as the scale of objects gets smaller, the gravitational forces associated with that scale get weaker and weaker and weaker. But I'd like to focus on that short distance regime, okay? And where the data was very poor. You ask, what might be special about gravity at this short length scale? Okay. Well, there's some hints. Diwali, Demopoulos, and Akani Hamed have pointed out that the old problem of the great discrepancy between the mass scale of gravity, 10 to the 16th TeV, and the mass scale of the rest of physics that we understand, particle physics is somewhere on the order of TeV, that enormous disparity could possibly be explained if some of the extra dimensions of string theory were large in the case of a particular scenario, a size roughly a millimeter. Okay, in that case, what you would find is, since this scenario says gravity isn't really so weak compared to everything else, it just appears weak because we can't see the full strength of gravity, which is leaked out into the extra dimensions, but none of the rest of physics is aware of these extra dimensions. Okay, in this case, you'd expect if you could get objects separated by a distance comparable to or smaller than the size of the extra dimensions, gravity would suddenly become anomalously strong. Okay. Another completely independent hint is that the cosmological constant determined from CMB, distant supernovae, and so on, corresponds to an energy density of about 4 keV for every cubic centimeter of space, no matter how much the volume of space grows. Okay. That energy density, the fourth root of it, corresponds to a length of a tenth of a millimeter. Okay. That length might be a fundamental scale associated with gravity. Okay. And then finally, there's just a generically interesting mass scale, which is some seesaw kind of mass, which corresponds to a length of about a millimeter. And so there are reasons to see what is gravity doing at short distances. Okay. We know that, Coulomb's law, the relativistic generalization of Coulomb's law, works down to 10 to the minus 16 centimeters from E plus E minus colliders and so on. People, tended to assume that the gravitational inverse square law must hold down to Planck lengths or something like that, but we only knew it, to a down to a few millimeters. Okay? A lot can happen below a length scale of a few millimeters. Okay. So the idea is just shown schematically here. Suppose this is not a very good accurate plot. Suppose that is the inverse square law, and the one suggestion was gravity could become anomalously strong at short distances. The other scenario, which was made by Sundra, said that you could explain why the cosmological constant has the size, the sign that it does, but is so weak compared to the predictions of the vacuum energy, quantum mechanical prediction of the vacuum energy density. If the graviton were a big floppy object whose form factor caused it not to see most of the short distance physics that happened inside its size, I don't want to get into a discussion about the theory because it's not really in a very strong footing. But the idea was, Sundrum suggested that if you got inside this dark energy length scale of about a tenth of a millimeter, you ought to see that the gravitational force weakened. This shows the instrument, principle of the instrument that we developed for testing the inverse square law at short distances. There is a torsion pendulum whose active component is a ring. The ring has 10 holes bored into it. It sits above a uniformly rotating attractor that also has 10 holes bored into it. And the gravitational interaction between the missing mass in those holes and the missing mass in these holes causes the pendulum to twist back and forth 10 times for every rotation of the attractor. Okay? So what we've done is, by having 10 holes, we have caused the frequency of our signal to be different from the frequency of our disturbance. Our disturbance frequency is the rotation rate of this attractor, and the signal is a twisting back and forth at 10 times the rotation frequency of this attractor. In fact, it's not sinusoidal exactly, so there are components at 10 times, 20 times, 30 times, 40 times, and so on. Okay? The next feature is that this attractor actually consists of two disks, and the thin upper disk and the thicker lower disk. The thicker lower disk has its holes halfway in between the holes in the upper disk. And the idea is it's been designed so that if Newton were exactly true, at some particular separation, the 10 times signal in this upper ring due to the gravitational interaction with the upper set of 10 holes would be exactly canceled by the interaction of these holes with the lower set of 10 holes. Okay? But any new physics associated with short distances could not be canceled simply because these lower set of holes are too far away. Okay? So that's the idea. The whole thing, the execution depends on getting rid of non-gravitational signals. That's the hard part, not getting the sensitivity, but getting rid of all the... And this shows a photograph of what you see here, the 10 holes. And what you see below the pendulum here, this is a mirror image of the pendulum in a very tightly stretched conducting foil that sits between the pendulum and the rotating attractor. Normally, the pendulum is much, much closer to this foil. Typically, the distance is this pendulum is less than a diameter of a hair away from the foil. But we take data at all set of separations. And time is running on, but this shows what we observed in that first experiment. This is the torque at the 10 times the rotation frequency as a function of the separation between the attractor and the pendulum. And this is the data taken with only the upper attractor present. We didn't have that lower attractor that does the canceling in there. And you can see the signal is just enormous. That shows the degree to which we cancel Newtonian signal. And you see there's a particular separation at which there is the 10 times frequency just vanishes, okay? And at short distances, the signal gets bigger. At longer distances, a signal changes sign. And what's shown below are the residuals to a Newtonian assumption. And this curve right here is what you'd expect for alpha of 1 and a range of 0.25 millimeter. And you can see that's ruled out very handily. Experiments were also done after we reported our result at the University of Colorado. They reported on a situation where the experiment was based on a kind of planar geometry. They had a diving board, a little mini diving board that oscillated up and down at about a kilohertz. And then they had a very unusual kind of torsion oscillator that consisted of those two plates that oscillated out of phase at this mode where they're oscillating out of phase like that. And what they were looking for was a twist of this plate as the diving board vibrated up and down to one side of the plate due to some gravitational interaction between the diving board and the plate. Okay? Now, this didn't have the feature that the disturbance and the signal were at different frequencies. The disturbance was at a kilohertz, and they're looking for a kilohertz signal. So vibration isolation was very important for those people. And at Stanford University, Aaron Kapitolnik's group did an experiment using micro cantilevers. These are things manufactured, you know, by the techniques of the semiconductor industry, where there's a little beam here and a test mass on the end of the beam, and a fiber interferometer measures the deflection of this little test mass. As a attractor oscillates underneath, the attractor contains alternately low-density material, silicon, and high-density material, gold, and you're looking to see if the attractor bounces up and down, you know, deflects up and down in a way that's synchronized with what kind of material is passing underneath. The constraints from all of these experiments are shown right here, along with some of the theoretical suggestions for effects, okay? I'd like to point out the dark energy length scale is this band right here, and the gravitational strength is alpha of 1, and so none of these experiments really reached the gravitational sensitivity at the dark energy length scale. Okay? To make them better, our experiments were easily the most sensitive of the modern ones. To make our experiments better, it's worthwhile appreciating a little scaling relation. If we are interested in short-range physics, and you want to use techniques such that we have, the torque on the pendulum is the derivative of the energy due to the short-range physics with respect to the twist of the torsion pendulum. Okay? And that's going to be proportional to the overlap energy, the ratio of the derivative of the overlap area, rather, with respect to the twist angle, okay? And so that the torque turns out to be proportional to the derivative of the overlap energy with respect to angle times the density of the pendulum and attractor times the Yukawa term like that. So you see it gets harder as the cube of the length scale, roughly speaking. And so our next generation instrument looks like this. We have, it says 21 hole. It's really a 42 hole torsion pendulum. So we have many more smaller scale holes. Okay? We have a continuous gravitational octopole calibration, and everything is better than in the previous version. And this shows you the results we saw. There's the torque at 21 times rotation frequency, 42, 63, 84, and so on. The higher frequencies don't provide very useful constraints because the inertia of the pendulum causes the signals at the higher frequency just to get too small to be useful. But now, here, this shows gravitational strength at a range of 100 microns before it was 250 microns in the earlier transparent. Again, you can see that's ruled out. And now this is getting close to the dark energy length scale. And this shows the new result that, from that 42-hole pendulum. And you see it has sensitivity of gravity, alpha of 1, at the dark energy length scale. Okay. Now, what's interesting is I take that same, take the data, but plot it versus length scale horizontally, but change the logarithmic scale at a tenth of a millimeter so that you can see the points taken at short distances more clearly. Okay? And what you see is that, in fact, at short distance, there's a systematic tendency for the points to lie, the residuals to lie, to be negative. Okay? A negative residual corresponds to a repulsive component of gravity, okay, or a weakening of gravity, or whatever. Okay? Is it real? Unfortunately, we don't know yet. So what we have to do are the following. We have to first check, is there something that we just don't understand about the experiment? Okay. And so what we're doing right now is we've shaved 140 microns off of the lower attractor plate. That changes where the Newtonian signal is exactly canceled. So it's exactly canceled at a much shorter length scale, a much shorter separation, I mean. And so what we're doing is we make the Newtonian contribution to our signal at small separations much smaller. Okay? And if that result agrees with the previous one, then we will feel quite confident there isn't something we don't understand about the experiment. Okay. In that case, we still have to distinguish, is what we're seeing gravity or is it something complicated and electromagnetic? Okay. I mean, could it be somehow that this conducting foil, which is a 10 micron thick beryllium copper membrane, could that somehow be transmitting electromagnetic effects to between the attractor and the pendulum? Okay. A number of theorists at the University of Washington and also at MIT have been looking at this question. Could there be some kind of Casimir, finite temperature Casimir effect that gets through that foil? The conclusion that the theorists have come to is no, you can't get it. Okay? But you know, as an experimentalist, I would like to actually check that because it's you know, maybe it's something else electromagnetic. So the idea is we're going to replace the molybdenum pendulum with a ring with an aluminum ring. Okay, if it's gravity, the effect ought to be down by the ratio of the densities. If it's electromagnetism, it should be virtually unchanged. You put one conductor instead of another one. And so that's a way we will test. We have the part made, but we're still taking data on that version. Okay. The answer is that the data right now is with the thinner lower attractor is inconclusive. It's consistent both with the previous result and with our with no new physics. Okay. We have a design in the works for a super duper experiment. It's based on a attractor and a pendulum that have this form factor. That quarter, that's a US quarter. That's not really there. That's to show you the scale of the things, okay? And the scale is, these are only 50 microns thick, and these gaps are about 50 microns wide here. And this has 120-fold rotational symmetry, so that the derivative of the area with respect to the angle is very high in this case. These materials are made of rhenium, which has a density of 20, about 20 and so on. So this is a super-duper design. The only question is, can you make it with enough precision? And so just to summarize, the inverse square law part to probe the true geometry of the universe, you need to study gravity. Okay, it's done most directly by testing inverse square law. A lot of the interest is in very short distances, although Guy Adivali will talk to you about what's also interesting at large length scales. Okay, our tests have shown that the inverse square law holds down to a length scale of about 80 microns, okay, at 95% confidence. If you ask what is the largest possible value for an extra dimension, okay, from these results we'd say it has to be smaller than 63 microns. Okay, if you had two equal extra dimensions, okay, you know, that's an arbitrary scenario, and then the size of the extra dimensions would be 53 microns, which corresponds to a unification scale of 2.4 TeV. Okay, we do see something at shorter distances. We don't know if it's real. I wish, you know, I'd given this talk half a year from now, in which case I could tell you for sure what the answer is. I just close with something amusing. We did the experiment with a 10-hole pendulum, and some reporter called up and said, is the reason you have 10 holes in the pendulum because there are 10 dimensions in string theory? And I said, no, no. It had nothing to do with it. It was because we wanted to have two times a number you don't find in the laboratory, and you don't find five-fold symmetric objects in the lab, okay? And we wanted two so we could put little spheres in the opposite corners and calibrate, okay? And then we did a 26-hole pendulum. and now we have a 42-hole pendulum. You know the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? In the case of the 42 holes, it's because we now have an octopole calibration to reduce the noise from, you know, people walking by and trucks and so on. And so that's 3 times 7 times 2 and so on. So arguments that had nothing to do with these amusing coincidences have led us in each case to a number which has, you know, some meaning to the outside world. Thank you very much.
So maybe you don't want to answer this, but if we assume your experimental your positive signal is true, as far as I could tell, the sign of the signal is wrong for scalar exchange and wrong for any naive modification of gravity. So would the alternative be that there's somehow a vector repulsive interaction, and is that consistent, or is there some alternative theoretical interpretation?
Okay, it's a mighty big if it's real, okay, which I don't know that it is, okay. If it is real, everything you said is right, except possibly the statement about naive interpretations, because I would put Sundrum speculation in that category, okay. And it is consistent with his speculation. It is a
question. By naive, I meant extra dimensions opening up.
Okay. So no, it can't be extra dimensions because it's got the wrong sign. It can't be a scalar interaction because it's got the wrong sign. It could be a some vector interaction. It could be a Sundrum type effect. But all of that's predicated on assuming it's real, which I don't know that it is. And I don't want to, unfortunately, a graduate student of mine, a relatively new one, gave a talk at a Slack workshop, and a lot of people read too much into it, okay? We don't know that there's anything real. And I should point out that at these short distances, at distances greater than 100 microns, our noise is very nearly the thermal noise due to the Brownian motion of this pendulum with a Q value of around 4,000. At shorter distances, there is an extra component to the noise, okay, which is some electrostatic kind of thing. Okay, and so the place where we're seeing the anomaly is also where there is an extra component of the noise. Now, noise, we're not naive. I mean, we're taking into account the extra noise, okay? But it's a true statement that the place where we see the anomaly is also where there is a non-thermal component to the noise.
I think I can address the question that was asked in the back earlier. There is dark matter inside the solar radius. In fact, the velocity of the sun around the galactic center is faster by, I forget, like 1.5 times than it would be if it were only luminous matter.
But that's not due to the dark matter in this, inside the not rays inside of the Earth. No. He was asking about dark matter between the Earth and the sun, I thought.
I thought you were asking between the galactic center and the sun.
No, solar radius. I meant the, you know, the radius from the solar system to the center of the galaxy.
Oh, I misunderstood you. So my answer was wrong. I thought you were saying, could we say something about the dark matter inside the Earth's orbit around the sun? So, okay. Yes, that's exactly what our test was doing then.
Right.
I misunderstood you. Thank you for clarifying it. Okay. That's what we were testing. Roughly a quarter of the acceleration of the solar system towards the center of the galaxy is thought to be due to the dark matter that lies inside that radius.
Yeah, but I understand that the amount of dark matter is not uncontroversial.
You know, I don't know what the uncertainty is, but people say 0.3, 0.4 GeV per cubic centimeter. Okay, so not a huge uncertainty anymore. I mean, no factor of 10 or any of that. So there's definitely some there. But what can you say about MOND?
I hate it. look, I tried. Okay, the classic MOND isn't even a theory. Okay, now Bekenstein has this thing which I don't quite. In fact, I would like to find out from you experts here what you think of that. Okay, but the trouble is, you know, I'd love to have something you could test. Okay, does it make an absolutely firm prediction so you could, you know, really get in there and test it, okay? And certainly the classic MOND did not, okay? Because there is this magic acceleration which is, you know, huge compared to our ability to resolve differential accelerations, okay? Huge. But, you know, they say, well, but, you know, it depends on the absolute acceleration. Well, absolute acceleration with respect to what, so to speak, okay? And it's just never defined so that I can find a way to test it. And I've tried to think, okay? And so that's why I hate it. I can't see a way to make a real test, okay?
Okay, I think we...
I realize MOND is a Canadian thing, so I hope I'm not being impolite.
All right, one more question here?
So, if I assume that there are no systematic effects, and I appreciate you don't want to do that yet, how statistically significant is this dip below the line?
I'll tell you, but I really don't want you to misinterpret it.
Yeah, sure.
Okay? It's about 4 sigma. But, you know, I think I'm really wary of giving an impression that I don't have, okay? You really have to test these things very carefully.
Okay, shall we thank our speaker again? Our next speaker is Giat Valli. His title of his talk is Cosmology and Gravity at the Largest Observable Distances.